calling the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so Representative Cagle, if you would start walking through your bill, House File 1300, that would be great.
And if you bring a baby to committee, don't you have to share it?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. This House File 1300 is the Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. I don't know why that I would be the one to carry this bill. but really, you know, this bill would designate the month of May as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month in recognition of, you know, making sure that we get the education and treatment options out to people who are facing postpartum depression. And this is, you know, up to one-third of mothers have symptoms of postpartum depression. I just saw a story on the news last night about a breakthrough treatment for postpartum depression. And so I think that this is very timely. And Clara's got some things to say about it, too. So, and with that, I'll just turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Troyer, and this is my husband, Harry Gottwald. On June 7th, 1975, we became very proud first-time parents to our precious baby girl, Stacy Ann Gottwald. Our little girl grew up to become a smart, intelligent woman who had a zest for life. At the age of 41, Stacy gave birth to her own precious baby girl. She had a healthy, normal pregnancy and birth. However, shortly after birth, Stacy became very anxious, and every day it escalated into psychosis. On August 16th, 2016, our Stacy took her life due to maternal mental health issues. Her beautiful baby girl, Sage, was only 6 months old. Stacy sought out many treatments, including counselors, acupuncture, and participating in a mother-baby program. Anne was hospitalized 3 times at different hospitals, being admitted to their mental health units. Stacy did not want to go back into a hospital because she felt their programs weren't helping, and she was right. Hospital inpatient units and her counselors proved inadequate, because they did not know how to treat her perinatal mood and anxiety disorder. And they approached this from the mental health side. By passing this very important bill, designating May as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month, it would shed light on this widespread problem and start conversations between moms and caregivers and help educate those who are impacted by pregnancy and postpartum and anxiety disorders. If this bill passes, it would be a huge step forward to develop training, certification, and licensing in hospitals, birthing centers, as well as labor and delivery units in areas of perinatal care. Women need to understand that postpartum depression is very prevalent and common and should be able to easily seek help without shame. And this bill will help put that into motion. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We now have a quorum, and so I'm going to move the bill. So I move that House File 1300 be recommended for placement on the general register. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Is there discussion from the committee? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Cagle and to the testifiers, thank you very much for bringing the bill and opening up a discussion on this really, really critical topic. I know that I speak for the whole committee when I say we're very, very sorry for your loss. I've known other women who've had postpartum depression. It can happen to anyone. And way too often, people don't understand what's happening. And so I really commend you for trying to shed more light on this. And, of course, maternal depression hurts children very much as well and obviously has huge ramifications. So I just wanted to thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I agree, maternal mental health is a huge issue that we don't talk enough about, and it causes significant amount of morbidity in our society. The United States Task Force has recommended screening for this at visits, but even then, we still miss it. So the more attention that we can bring to it, the better. So thank you.
Thank you.
There being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House Bill 1300 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. House Bill 1300 is recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you.
Congratulations, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
So now that we have a quorum, would someone make a motion to move them to approve the minutes from March 19th, 2019? Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Albright moves to approve the minutes from March 19th, 2019. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay, next we have House File 1285, Representative Mueller. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, I mispronounced your name, Kelly Moe. The chair moves that House Bill 1285 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Mueller, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair, yes.
The chair will entertain a motion for the A11 author's amendment.
So moved.
Representative Pinto moves the A11 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Mueller, please present your bill.
Thank you so much. And I will say this is the first time before this committee, and I forgot to bring down Girl Scout cookies. They are in my office, so if anybody would like to join me for cookies later.
That's more than a problem. You can bring them later.
All right. So, Madam Chair and members, House File 1285, as amended, would expand consumer-directed community supports, or also known as CDCS, an option for individuals accessing Minnesota's home and community-based service waivers, which offers people with disabilities and their family members more choice and control over the services and supports that they receive. And I'm here with you today as the lead author of this bill because my constituent, Lynn McDonald, spoke with me about the critical importance of CDCS for her family, and specifically her children, Adam and Rebecca, who are also here with us today. And as you'll learn from Lynn during her testimony in a few minutes, CDCS allows their family to select the right services at the right time to meet their needs. Individuals accessing CDCS have more flexibility in hiring and setting wages for their staff and can purchase non-traditional supports like special therapies and assistive technology and equipment, which is more cost-effective and also reduces constraints on the workforce. Person-centered, cost-effective options like CDCS are the direction that we must prioritize in reforming services and supports for people with disabilities in Minnesota. And giving people the power to have control over their lives, their funding, and their services in a more individualized, truly community-based settings will save money in the long run and is the very best option for families like the McDonald's. And before Lynn shares her story, I'd also like to introduce Vicki Garretts, who will provide some more information. And then I'll just note, too, that this bill did receive a hearing in the Senate. It's got bipartisan support in both chambers. Thanks.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Vicki Garretts, and I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at ACRA. ACRA is a statewide fiscal management service provider for approximately 1,500 individuals who use consumer-directed community supports, or CDCS, in Minnesota. CDCS is an option for individuals utilizing home and community-based service waivers that provides them and their families with more choice and control over their services and their budget. Individuals who use CDCS work with their lead agency and a fiscal management service provider, such as ACRA, and have the option to use a support planner, all who help monitor the service and the waiver dollars. Individuals hire and train their own staff and decide the wages they want to pay their employees, which are typically higher than in traditional services. I want to thank Representative Mueller for authoring this bill. And this bill aims to do three things. First, the bill would fund a statewide education campaign to raise awareness of the benefits of the CDCS option and provide information to individuals with disabilities, their families, and lead agency staff about how the program works, the benefits over traditional services, and the resources and supports that are available. Even though CDCS has been available in Minnesota since the late 1990s, there are still areas of the state where little or no information or misinformation is provided to individuals and families about CDCS. Second, the proposal would carve out intensive behavioral support services from the individual CDCS budget, while still providing those intensive supports as needed but paid for through the county waiver allocation. This will help avoid crisis placement, allowing individuals to stay in their homes and still receive staffing and other important services without needing to divert all their money in their budget for those behavioral services. And third and most importantly, the bill allows individuals to share services. I know you're all very well aware of the workforce crisis that we're currently dealing with. Shared services, structured similarly to the shared care option with the Personal Care Assistance Program, would allow family members or friends to effectively share a single staff person to provide supports in the home or in the community. Parents with multiple disabilities often don't want or cannot find one staff for each child in their home. So when multiple siblings access CDCS, shared services would allow families to stretch each child's budget, creating even more flexibility to meet individualized needs and provide consistency in staffing to ease some of our workforce challenges. Our understanding is that for this, there would be an IT cost, but that's the only cost for this part. Here with me today is Lynn McDonald, a parent of adult children with disabilities who utilize the CDCS option. She will speak about the critical importance of establishing a mechanism for shared services. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lynn McDonald, and I live in Shoreview, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1285 and to Representative Moeller for her leadership as the chief author of this important bill. I have two adult children, a daughter, Rebecca, and my son, Adam. Adam is 25, Rebecca is 27. Both whom have Down syndrome, and Adam also has autism. After my daughter was born in December of 1991 with significant medical needs, I could no longer work outside my home and gave up my career. She needed extensive heart surgery to survive. Due to the risk of infection, she couldn't be around people, so we remained housebound until she gained enough weight to survive surgery in January of 1992. We were then housebound again until the next summer, until she was out of danger. My son was born prematurely in November of 93 and remained hospitalized until December. He was then rehospitalized in March of 1994. Citing my children's many medical needs that required constant care and supervision, both private and center-based daycare facilities refused us. It's been very difficult financially. But in 1998, my children were approved for the waiver. We chose the consumer-directed community supports, or the CDCS option, under the waivers because it gives us the flexibility and choice they both need and allows us to manage their funding in the most self-directed way. It has helped them tremendously. My significant other, Robert, and I provide 24/7 care for Becca and Adam. Each day we provide individual care, including help and assistance with their daily scheduling, med distribution and application, bathing, dressing, all forms of personal hygiene, job transportation, etc. And shared care is critical in ensuring that we can care for both of them together, including meal prep, transportation, class attendance, community outings, Special Olympics, out-of-town travel, shopping, doctor's appointments, vocational rehab visits, and PT appointments. By creating a mechanism for shared care, House File 1285 would help those of us who do the difficult work of caring for more than one loved one with special needs in their home. Thank you for your time and consideration, and thank you all for serving our community.
Thank you for your testimony, and thanks to all three of you for being here.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1285? Discussion from the committee. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if Ms. Garretts, I have a question for Ms. Garretts. Thank you, Ms. Garretts. In your testimony, you mentioned that there would be a nominal IT cost. I'm just wondering if you could expound on that and whose responsibility that is and how much you anticipate that would cost you, if you have been told any estimate on that.
Ms. Garretts.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We are working with the Department of Human Services on the fiscal note.
Chairs. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, my name is Alex Bartolik. When a fiscal note's requested, we will go through and identify any of the costs and what the purpose is and who would the responsibility for it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
I'm just trying to understand what cost or what the what IT would be necessary.
Ms. Brotalik.
Madam Chair and Representative, it has to do with how we are going to manage documenting which workers, so we can match up workers with the billing in order to verify that these are appropriate payments so that the system doesn't think they're duplicative payments for the same time period.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just wondering if you could remind me in terms of where this bill is traveling next.
Well, it's going to Ways and Means next.
With a recommendation to go to Health Finance.
HHS Finance, I'm guessing.
I don't know why he's looking at me, but yes, probably.
No, just
Ways and Means to HHS Finance.
Yes.
I've got nothing left.
Chair Chair Liebling, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Sorry, threw me off there. Yeah, I do have a question. I was noticing in the amendment that I'm interested in the service that's being carved out from the general budget that folks are given. And so I noticed the language changed in the amendment. You've narrowed it down quite a bit, but so now it says that behavioral interventions may include any services not identified in the community support plan, but are needed to prevent imminent crisis placement or institutionalization, or to intervene in a crisis. So, could you give some examples of what that would be,
Ms. Garretts?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Some of the services that have been identified are things like the Metro Crisis Coordination Program, could be behavioral specialists, behavioral analysts, specialist services, things that would be needed on a very short-term basis to prevent that crisis from needing crisis placement.
Chair Liebling.
Madam Chair, so thank you. Is there a definition of imminent? I mean, I know you've tried to narrow this some, which I appreciate, but what you're doing here is kind of a departure, I think, probably for the first time from what this program is supposed to do, which is give people a budget for all of the services that they need under the waiver. And so this is kind of adding in something now on top of that. And so I'm wondering if there's a good definition. Maybe I haven't had a chance to read this thoroughly, the amendment, but you know, how are we going to define imminent? How is it going to be determined whether the additional support that somebody needs is outside of, to be paid for in addition to the rest of the waiver payment, is going to meet these criteria?
Ms. Garrett.
And thank you. I believe that is something we would work with the department to come up with what that, kind of define that service. And currently right now there is another service that does have money outside of the budget, and that's the environmental modifications. You know, the first $5,000 is in their budget, and then the rest of it, if it's above that, can come from the county aggregate and not have to come out of the budget. So there already is a service that does that within CDCS.
So, Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, well, and so is it intended that this is a one-time thing that, you know, if this happens to somebody and they have a crisis and they need something urgently, that it'll be paid for? Or is it intended then that it is, you know, I'm just looking for kind of what the limits are going to be to this. And as it goes for a fiscal note, I suppose you have to you do probably have to define that better.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and Representative, how we have been talking about it is this is something that comes up past the assessment. And so it's something that's typically short term. It's to prevent that crisis. If there's behaviors that are going to continue or situations, then it would come through in that next assessment is how we're thinking about it. But again, we're working with the department to really kind of work through what this would look like for this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Chair Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I like the idea of continuing to promote the consumer-directed services, and I think it's really given, it plays well into the waiver reform that we've encouraged and the state is now presenting before us of individualized budgets so that people select the services that best fit their need as opposed to just getting a set menu of services that, you know, may be useful but not the most useful to their own personal goals. But I do have a concern about this taking behavioral interventions and making that separate rather than, and it seems to me that right now if someone on a waiver has a sudden situation arise, no matter what the crisis is, I don't know that we bill back and tell them that they have to pick up that MA cost. So it seems kind of odd that we're saying a short-term emergency unanticipated thing suddenly has to be handled separately. Because I don't think we bill separately for those crisis services to the individual who receives them in the community. So I'd have you look at that and whether or not we even need this. But if we did, I think we should honor the idea of individual budgeting and say up to X dollars is available as needed, and it can be part of the assessment. If you know someone is pretty unstable, they're being discharged from Anoka Regional Treatment Center, they think they are stable enough, but nobody really knows how they're going to handle the stressors of being back in the community, and so you might, with the assessor, say, we think we need a backup plan in case there's a sudden emergency, and have up to so much as needed. There's always appeal processes and other ways to make things work, but I think rather than a blanket exception, maybe honor that same individual budget approach.
Ms. Garrett or Representative Mueller, would either of you like to speak to that?
No, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think that's something that we could definitely consider as this bill continues to move forward. And I'll just say, too, it's my understanding from this that that these services can really eat up the CDCS budget, and that it's often hard for families to budget for a crisis because you don't know when a crisis is going to hit. So that's really the intent behind this portion of the bill. But your point is well taken, and yours, too, Chair Liebling. I think these are things that can be worked out as the bill moves forward.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering how many people are enrolled already in CDCS?
Ms. Garrett?
I'm Madam Chair, Representative. I'm looking to DHS. Is it 10,000? Okay, they'll get the number for you.
Okay. Madam,
Representative Gale?
Then I also was wondering, do we have any idea how many would consider shared services?
Ms. Garrett.
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't. I mean, we know there's many families that have multiple children receiving services and receiving consumer-directed community supports, but I don't know if the department has that number either.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, there be no further discussion. The chair renews her motion that House File 1285 as amended be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? House File 1285 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Congratulations. Thank you. House File 1543, Representative Dean. The chair moves that House File 1543 be recommended for placement on the general register. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair, if someone would be willing to move the 1543 A2 amendment.
The chair will entertain a motion for the A2 author's amendment.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson moves the A2 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Dean, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. House File 1543 deals with an issue that is somewhat specific to substance use disorder treatment field. Currently in the Minnesota statutes, how we allow individuals to get engaged in the working at these centers has been at question for quite some time. I personally think back to my experience in a treatment center long time ago, and the thought of someone who did not have the experiences that I had telling me that there was life after use would have seemed totally absurd. But individuals that have walked in those similar shoes that I had, as they talked to me about their experiences and talk to me about how my experiences could be different, was really, really critical. For quite some time now, Minnesota has made it, if not impossible, really, really difficult for someone who, during their substance use or abuse, did something that ran afoul with the law. They were often disqualified from being able to practice in the field, and we know that it's a field that's critical for the well-being of a lot of people and their abilities to lead their best lives. So I'm going to could go on and on and talk about things, but I'm not going to. I actually have some testifiers here, and I'd like them to actually speak to specifically what the bill does, and then we'll be happy to answer questions. And I don't know if we have anyone from the department here if they'd like to speak as well. So I'll turn it over to Tim Walsh. He's with the Minnesota Teen and Adult Challenge, and he will speak to this.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm here representing March. I'm one of the vice presidents at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge over long-term recovery and mental health services. The bill that's before you today actually passed in a similar form last year in the House and Senate, but didn't get across the finishing line and actually received bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate, and has bipartisan support already in the Senate. Since that time, the Department of Human Services Office Inspector General has worked with us providing technical assistance, and they have refined this bill so that it better meets its purposes, the purposes that were laid out by the representative. As he said, the people in recovery often commit crimes as a part of their addiction. But they turn their lives around. They go to treatment. They're in recovery. And then they are the most motivated, the most inspirational role models that we can possibly have in treatment. And yet, as the statute is currently written, what happens right now when they get a letter that disqualifies them, they then try to seek a set-aside. But 80% of the people, according to the Department of Human Services, drop out of the process at that point. So 80% of the people, for whatever reason, probably discouragement, and Troy can speak to that, drop out of that process. And we looked at this, and we felt that based upon the data, that the folks that we work with are actually quite safe. They don't pose a risk to this population. In fact, we think they're going to be the most impactful staff working with our clients in SUD treatment. Right now at Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge, we had 50 people across our system that were flagged for disqualification due to the statute as it's currently written. And then speaking for March, there's a severe workforce shortage in the substance use disorder treatment field right now, and we need exactly this profile of worker to come in and to work with us. So that's what we're presenting here today, and we are hoping for your support. And turn over to Troy Jelinek.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Troy Jelinek, and I currently work at Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge in their short-term licensed treatment center. I have for the last 4 years. Prior to that, I was a heroin and meth addict for 20 years. In that 20 years, I went to multiple treatment centers, jails and prison, multiple overdoses, and I came to my breaking point and was done. In that 20 years, I did have some run-ins with the law, and I acquired a couple felonies from possession of drugs. When I was 2 years into my sobriety, I decided I wanted to give back and take the information of that 20 years that I went through and overcame and use it for good. I applied for Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge and was flagged but was able to still work under supervision. A year into my employment, I was flagged and marked as disqualified.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was disqualified to work, and that was devastating for me, and it was devastating for my family, it was devastating for my kids. I was a year into working and getting a stable life and giving back to all the clients that we have. We have a lot of clients, and the process to that was pretty strenuous, and I only received 15 days to do it. It dug up my past. I answered all the questions to the drug possession charges that disqualified me, and my family, it affected them because they didn't know, was I going to lose my job? I was just recently married, and my kids. It affected a lot more than me. It affected the clients at work, too. I was ultimately approved and given a set-aside. And I truly believe that that was the right decision. And I truly believe that there are some crimes out there, like of violence, for example, or where there's victims, where this needs to be done. For the protection of anyone who is considered a vulnerable adult. But I believe my drug possessions, it'd be easier not to have to even bring all that up, considering that's what I kind of use as my resume with the clients.
Mm-hmm.
I can sympathize and empathize with almost every single client that we have. And I believe that my history makes me a very impactful employee with these residents that we have. With this bill, it would make it a lot easier for people getting a job in our center. I occasionally help others now that are disqualified because I went through it, and I was given help, and I take that help, and I pass it along. And I have witnessed myself very good employees give up because they don't want to dig into their past. They don't want to answer the questions. And quite frankly, they feel that, they just don't want to dig up their past. And it's easier to live life without doing that. And I think it's been catastrophic for us. That's all I have.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Yes. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on behalf of House Bill 1543? Is there discussion from the committee? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, thank you for bringing this bill forward and for the work that Dalton King Challenge does. Mr. Walsh, your work is admirable, and to the gentleman sitting to your left, thank you for the service that you provide on behalf of the clients. Representative Dean, I just have a question with regard to the exceptions on the bottom of page 2, starting at line 2.3 and 2.31, and this is not intended to serve as anything other than just clarification in terms of, could you just remind the members of the committee what those sections of statute relate to?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. It's certain classifications of offenses, whether they're violent, drug-related, nonviolent, and other types of things. And what we're trying to make sure is, as the gentleman spoke, there are people that have done things that they probably shouldn't be working in treatment centers. This changes it. So those individuals that have done things that probably aren't a cause or concern, that it allows them the opportunity. So that's the intent of this, is that you're not disqualified for those offenses, so nonviolent crimes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up for Representative Dean. I would imagine that this has met the due diligence of both law enforcement as well as the judiciary. We have a drug enforcement court in Scott County, so we certainly empathize with this effort. But if you just nod yes or no, that judiciary as well as law enforcement has been made aware of these exceptions.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any concern that's been brought forward by law enforcement or the courts or anybody concerning this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, thank you for the bill. I urge our strong support.
Further discussion?
Yeah.
Chair Liebling.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm in support of this as well, and I think this kind of, we talk a lot around here about the workforce shortage across all kinds of areas, and one of the things that the workforce shortage is requiring is that employers have to be more flexible about people who may have things in their past or, you know, don't exactly meet their ideal vision of what their employees should be. But they have to reach out and they have to do more work to bring people into the workforce and give them an opportunity. And I think this is an area where we as state government have to kind of help participate in that, because we do have some of these rules that, are not helping with that. And I think this is a really good example of that. Frankly, I don't know if this is a law enforcement issue at all, because this really has only to do with the DHS set-aside process. Unless I'm wrong, and you can correct me, Representative Dean, this isn't giving anybody an expungement or anything like that. It's just changing the disqualification process. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, yeah, this does not give expungements. This is specific to the DHS process. And one thing that I'll add is, and I didn't talk about it in my opening statement, you know, every time someone that works in the field gets a job at another agency or center, they have to go through the process again, even though they've already received a set-aside for their previous employer. And remember, you know, that the process doesn't just affect the employee. The employer has a bunch of things that needs to happen as well. So this is something that's actually going to allow the opportunity not only I would say, to get counselors in front of clients that need those types of counselors. But it'll also help those individuals and those employers in their ability to provide the services necessary.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1543, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1543, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair,
and
thank you, members.
Thank you.
Next up, we have House File 2265, Representative Pinto. Representative Pinto, welcome to the testifiers table.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2265 be recommended for placement on the general register.
We have the bill before the committee. Representative Pinto, I understand you have an author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I would like to move the DE1 amendment. This will put the bill in the same form that it's in as it's been moving in the other body, and so I'd like to match that up.
Representative Pinto moves the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Pinto, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Members, as you'll see in the first paragraph of the bill, the Commissioner of Human Services is not allowed to set aside individual disqualification for certain services, regardless of how much time has passed, if the disqualification is for certain kinds of crimes. I have a constituent here who will testify in just a moment who had a conviction quite a long time ago, and you'll hear that, want to make sure that we can take advantage of at least have the opportunity to take advantage of work of folks like my constituent. I will say, members and Madam Chair, that I think there's a broader conversation to be had about collateral consequences and how disqualifications work. And in the meantime, I think that this, with the amended language, as I said, it's been moving through the other body, can work quite effectively. So with that, I'd like to turn things over, I think, to Mr. Fairbanks first. Yeah, to Mr. Fairbanks on the far side of me. And then to the other testifier. Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Stephen Michael Fairbanks. Okay.
Proceed with your testimony, please.
Well, I kind of got choked up a little bit with the last testimony here because I kind of fall into the same bill or the same principal as that gentleman was, or did. I did have some problems in my younger life prior to I was 18, up and past the age of 18. And it just kind of took a turn for the worse in my early adulthood. And unfortunately, I was found guilty of a felony of aggravated assault, and was something I did when I was 18 years old. But things had a way of changing around for the better part. It was a struggle of all the way uphill. And I was fortunate enough in the last 6 months or so to run into a group of people that really supported my cause and believed in me.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
And welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I should note Mr. Fairbanks' conviction was from the early 1970s, and so that's the conviction that has prohibited him from providing non-emergency medical transportation, as I understand it. I have his employer here who's with us as well who can provide some testimony.
Wonderful. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jeremy Kramer. I'm a manager at Blue and White Taxi. Thank you, Madam Chair, and all the representatives for our time. It's not just Mr. Fairbanks this affects. We have other drivers who were disqualified for things they did 30, 40, and he was almost 50 years ago. And, you know, they're trying to better their lives. And to be disqualified for them with our business, the way it's changed because of Uber and Lyft, our business model's changed to do more medical transportation. So something like this is very catastrophic to their family. Like 45% of their business is affected because they can't take those rides. We do have video cameras in the cabs, so it's not like they're completely just one-on-one with the customer and client. So we do have, you know, a vision of what's going on, and I just feel like people like Mr. Fairmix deserve that second chance to for their family and themselves.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2265? Is there a discussion from the committee? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill. I agree with you in terms of the collateral consequences. We're on public safety together. In terms of allowing people to come back into the community, we want you to be successful, but we put so many roadblocks up. So I'm a big supporter of this bill. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pinto, I agree that at some point when someone's had that long a history of not having problems, that we ought to set them free of those consequences. But I was just curious about, on line 1.8, it deletes the in the chemical dependency or corrections field. And I'm not really familiar with this section of law, but I'm wondering how broadly this will apply or if it even addresses the non-emergency medical transportation. We have so many complicated statutes that I'm just wanting to make sure that we know which kind of positions would be considered.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler. You'll see that actually the original draft of the bill kind of separated, left those in place and separated out. I will admit that a number of these changes came through the process in the other body, and I'm not quite sure. Maybe we've got Ms. Hilden who may be able to help us in providing the sense as to what the thinking was there.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Nancy Hilden, and I'm here on behalf of Blue and White. So this section of law, the way that the bill is before you now is amended to be in the form that the DHS preferred it. And by deleting the in the chemical dependency or corrections field, opens this up to allow anyone who has employment in a field such as non-emergency medical. So that's why they wanted to put this in here. And it does broaden it. It does, as a policy, create more opportunities for people who have a long ago criminal event in their life to come forward and not be permanently disqualified. A couple other changes that happened in the Senate from the original version, and this was at Senator Limmer's request and before his committee. One was to make sure that any crim-sex-related crimes were excluded from this permanent disqualification. So those crimes will remain permanent disqualifications. And then the second one was, I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember. I'm sorry.
I can't remember myself. Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Folks will know as well that the original just the time period is down to 20 years.
Yeah.
And it does, rather than separating out chemical dependency or corrections in one area, non-emergency medical transportation in the other, the idea is just in general, if we're going to apply this, it should apply throughout the programming, is my understanding.
Representative Loeffler, did you have follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I just wanted to make sure that we understood if we needed to, because otherwise next year we're going to have someone else who has a story and is under a different license, and wanted to make sure we're doing it broadly.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Pinto for bringing this bill forward. I, too, have a couple of constituents who have been very frustrated. They've done something, choices they made when they were much younger, and are unable to be employed in certain areas or quite often at all, and it becomes very frustrating for them to be able to be employed when they long ago changed their ways and are successful or want to be successful. And so I think this is a good action for us to be taking so that we can have people employed and be successful and be independent. So thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Representative Pinto renews his motion.
Representative Pinto. Thank you. Just really quickly, I should have noted my co-author, Representative Keel. We partnered on a number of bills and done that, but I was glad to have her on there. And thank you, because I do think there's a broader conversation to be had on this as well. But in the meantime, move this along. Thank you.
There being no further discussion, Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 2265 as amended be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2265 as amended is recommended for placement on the General Register. Congratulations. Next up is House File 1389. Representative Fisher. Representative Fisher, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1389 be recommended for placement on the General Register.
We have the bill before the committee. Representative Fisher, I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment. When this bill was being heard in the Senate, staff noticed an error that needed to be corrected on page 3 of the original bill, line 3.24. The title fee number was not the appropriate title fee number, and so what the amendment does is change the title fee number, the fee number there, to the appropriate number that should be, and adds the line at the end to correct the title numbers accordingly.
Would you like to move your amendment?
I would like to move the A1 amendment, please.
Representative Fisher moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Fisher, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. House File 1389 updates the Minnesota statute to address the rapidly evolving profession of long care administration. The National Association of Long-Term Care Administrators recently created a nationally portable health service executive licensure in a forward-looking approach to how long-term care providers are initially educated and licensed to practice along the continuum of care. In their public protection role, the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators responded to this innovative new license by requesting changes to the Minnesota statute, which would allow the health service executive license to be used in Minnesota. This new license is a higher credential than existing Minnesota licenses. Adding this voluntary option to the licensure expands the pathway to the licensure in Minnesota. It does not change or replace any existing options for licensure in Minnesota. The bill also updates some outdated technical language and moves existing fees from rules to statute. Heard last year in two House committees without any opposition, the bill was included in the omnibus bill, which was vetoed last year. With me today is Katie Davis, who is a board member of the Minnesota Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, and she's here to testify for the bill.
All right. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Davis, and I'm the administrator on record at Good Samaritan Society in Albert Lea, and also serve as the executive director at Good Samaritan Society in Austin. I serve on the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators as chair of the task force that worked with other stakeholders on this current language. I'm also very involved in changing the academic and standards for long-term care administrators at a national level through the National Association of Boards, and currently serve as the chair of the Home and Community-Based Services Examination Committee at the national level. It is a pleasure to be with you today to discuss HF 1389. Which is essentially a national portability of license issue while also resetting the academic requirements for new graduates of approved national programs. The success of this bill impacts my organization, the Good Samaritan Society, as we have over 66 communities in Minnesota, including Good Samaritans in Laverne, Austin, and Waconia. And we believe all those communities should be led by qualified leaders in long-term care services and supports. This bill allows for basically another pathway or fifth route to licensure within our great state by allowing individuals qualified as a health service executive to enter our state and work with Minnesota elders as the administrator of record. It is the highest standard of education and experience in the nation and is voluntary at this time. As a way of background, the National Association of Long-Term Care Administrator Boards proposed licensure by equivalency through state adoption of the Health Service Executive Qualification, which is on line 3.16 of the bill. This offers a solution to licensure portability. Licensure portability models based on a common competency standards have been successful in other professions, such as medical doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and occupational therapists. As an acceptable pathway for entry-level and experienced practitioners to demonstrate qualification for licensure. NAB proposes the new qualification standards of HSC as the highest level of education, experience, and examination as meeting the equivalency of licensure qualifications for nursing home administrators, assisted living administrators, and administrators of home and community-based services. The HSC Commission is created from the compact of participating states, those joined closely and firmly united to provide portability in achieving a high standard of leadership for tomorrow's long-term care supports and services. In response to this national initiative completed in 2016, the Minnesota Board of Examiners for Nursing Home Administrators engaged stakeholders to create the initial HSC licensure. Through the grandparenting clause, Minnesota currently has 191 qualified or seeking qualification as an HSC executive, or 17% of our state's administrators. The HSC bill made it through two House committees in 2018 with no opposition, and it was included in the vetoed omnibus bill. In the interim, the board, anticipating potential changes in assisted living, directed that we make purely non-controversial technical changes, to our statute and to assure contemporary practices. There are modest technical changes in the bill, again, all non-controversial. The remainder of the bill requires all fees to be in statute and removed from the rules. The fees are the same as 1995, or when I was in the second grade. So we've been very prudent stewards of our resources. There is no known opposition to the language and no increase in fees within this current bill. Randy Snyder, our awesome executive director to my right, will provide a short summary of the bill, and he will stand with any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Snyder, the executive director for the awesome Board of Examiners. I have 11 superb board members that serve voluntarily on that board. I think I'll just stand for questions. This is the fifth and voluntary approach for licensure. There's no opposition, no fee increase. We have to catch up now. North Dakota beat us to this last year. So Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Montana, other states have advanced. Wisconsin, Ohio, Iowa, and South Dakota are in the same process that we are. We also have to catch up. The University of Minnesota Crookston are producing graduates now for us. The University of Wisconsin Eau Claire producing graduates. They're coming to us, and so we do have to catch up to that. University of Minnesota Minneapolis is pending, in Concordia College. So this is good legislation, we feel. There was no opposition last year. And with that, I'll cut it short and just stand for questions.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 1389? Discussion from the committee. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to see you here. And the University of Minnesota Crookston has expanded the need for health executives, and that's really important in rural Minnesota. But I wanted to know, can you explain a little bit why the need for licensure?
Overall,
Mr.
licensure?
Snyder.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, CMS for Medicare and Medicaid services absolutely requires it. We're the only national required licensure in the state of Minnesota. So that's a good reason right there. We don't want to lose our Medicare and Medicaid money flowing into the state. Overall licensure, I think we set an educational pathway. Very important for people to understand how to get in this occupation. Right now, assisted living is getting a lot of attention. I got into long-term care based on sort of the same environment as right now because I wanted to make a change in elders' lives back in 1980. So licensure gives a pathway for people educationally. We work collaboratively with all of our education. There are 9 academic programs in the state. There are 15 nationally. And so we work with them to really give them the basic content. There are 5 basic areas required for licensure: understanding consumers, resident care, understanding the difference between Lewy body dementia and Alzheimer's, understanding the differences between Parkinson's, hallucinations, and Alzheimer's. There's a lot of technical issues that Katie has to live with every day. I should let her take over. The HR aspects, understanding workforce issues, critical. If you don't have good leadership and management, I don't know how you can really have a good environment. So those are the essentials. Other than it's required, those are the good reasons as to why licensure has become important, especially in this area.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
I'd also like to, you pointed out that North Dakota has beat us in these changes. Do you have health executives that serve both one state and another, and does that make it better for that ability to serve in 2 different states, or is that even a possibility?
Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, that's an interesting one. We're one of the first states to allow a shared administrator within the state. We don't have anyone that has crossed the border. North Dakota and Minnesota have very similar processes, though, and we do have similar qualifications that if you get licensed in either state, it's informal reciprocity, but it's very easy to move across the borders. There is no administrator right now that shares a site in one state, though, for another. Interesting question.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to point out, I guess in my neck of the woods, both it would be simple for East Grand Forks, Grand Forks, and Moorhead and Fargo to be able to share just because they're so in proximity to each other and the demands are there, although that's probably a larger group of people. But thank you.
Mr. Snyder, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair, I was just going to add that we do have a board member from Moorhead, Eventide, that they're across the river there, and so I appreciate the comment very much, Representative.
Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Representative Fisher renews his motion that House File 1389, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1389, as amended, is recommended for placement on the General Register. Congratulations. Last but not least.
Yeah.
House File 2206, Representative Albright. Representative Albright, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 2206 be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division.
We have the bill before the committee. Representative Albright, I understand you have an author's amendment.
Madam Chair, I do. I'd like to move the A19-0241 amendment.
Representative Albright moves the A19-0241 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 2 testifiers with me, and so I will make my presentation brief so that we can get to the heart of the matter. Currently, counselors are forbidden from disclosing information learned from a client without the client's written consent or a court order. This bill would provide a way for counselors treating people with mental illnesses to prevent an attack that the client said they were going to do. Currently, they are forbidden from informing anyone. I have with me the executive director for the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health, who is able to expand and explain the contents of the bill. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Rexigal. I'm Executive Director for the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. The board regulates approximately 6,000 professionals in the fields of alcohol and drug counseling, and professional clinical counseling. Some of you actually may recall that this bill is essentially the same bill. You heard it passed out of committee last year. This bill is budget neutral. There's no cost to the board or state to implement the proposed changes. You should have with you a pretty detailed handout on two sides that explains the main points of House File 2206. Sections 1 and 4 of the bill are designed to promote license portability for experienced counselors from other states, reduce some barriers to licensure, and add to Minnesota's mental health provider workforce. Seems to be a common theme today. And this proposal fits within nationwide efforts among the mental health professions to expand portability, make it easier for qualified licensed professionals to obtain licensure and practice across state lines. Sections 2, 3, and 5 of House File 2206 are technical changes to language already in statute. In 2016, duty to warn language was added to the Practice Acts for psychologists, marriage and family therapists, and alcohol and drug counselors. And this was done in response to a Minnesota appellate court decision. That court case revealed that psychology interns and persons in supervised post-degree practice were not allowed by statute to disclose private client information in instances when a client poses a serious threat of physical harm to himself, herself, or another person. So the technical changes in House File 2206 will extend those duty to warn language requirements to all the mental health professions. So this means that students, interns, postmaster supervisees, and licensees in the fields of psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy, and counseling will have the same responsibilities and protections of the duty to warn language in statute. So I am happy to answer any questions.
Do we have another testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I'm Alan Ingram, and I'm representing the Coalition of Licensed Social Workers in Minnesota and the Society for Clinical Social Workers. What brings us to the table here is that that court case, Expose versus Wilderson, in the Minnesota Supreme Court, it did establish that in order for interns and students to be covered, that they would have to be classified in some way as licensees or they wouldn't have immunity. And so the psychology student who attempted to prevent harm to another person ended up being sued for that because she wasn't technically licensed. So all these disciplines have done this. And we're one of the last to come to you to take care of social work trainees. We want to train these interns in mental health settings to recognize the specific threats to others and to prevent that harm if we can and be protected from civil suit for taking that risk because, you know, it affects the client relationship that you have when you do violate their confidentiality to warn someone else. But it's a balancing act. You're trying to prevent harm, and in trying to make that decision in the split amount of time that you might have in order to prevent the harm, you don't want to be thinking about whether you're laying yourself open for a lawsuit. So that's what this language is for. It's in this bill because it got into this same companion bill on the Senate side, so that's why we're here. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 2206? Discussion from the committee. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright, for bringing this bill. During clinical training, I was always taught the duty to warn, but I'm so glad that we have it in statute because I think that it's in practice, many of us do it, but it's better to have it in statute. So I was surprised because you and I had spoke. I was surprised that it wasn't there. So thank you so much for this bill.
Further discussion? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering about the section about reciprocity. And I don't think I heard anything about standards. I mean, this might be just fine, but often when we get into reciprocity, that's where people within the professions get nervous, and I haven't heard that there's any opposition to this, so heads are shaking, there's no opposition. So in terms of the training of these professions in other states and so on, is it pretty much equivalent wherever you train so that there wouldn't be any issues about Minnesota having higher standards, and then if we're doing reciprocity, we're letting people in who have lower standards? That's usually what you hear about these kinds of things, and maybe you could just give me a little comfort on that issue.
Would one of you like to speak to that? Ms. Retskillen.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, actually, last year you did ask for similar information, and so I did provide committee members last year with a summary of the requirements in all 50 states for all of our counseling types. And just by note, 12 jurisdictions require 48 semester credits, for instance, of graduate work for a master's level counseling license. And actually, this is equivalent to Minnesota. 36 states actually exceed our requirements and require 60 semester credits in graduate coursework. There's only one state below Minnesota, and that's, I think it's Wisconsin, with 42 semester credits. Virtually all of the other jurisdictions require postmaster's supervised practice and national examination. The requirements for alcohol and drug counselors vary more widely. Some states are certification states, not full licensure states, but again, education and examination includes all 50 jurisdictions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have a follow-up? No. Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2206 as amended be recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 2206 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division. Congratulations. Before we adjourn, we are not meeting on Friday, just a reminder. So we will reconvene Tuesday at 2:30, and we are now adjourned.